Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
As the CIA station chief in Islamabad during the first Afghan war, Robert Grenier drafted the original war plan for the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, which was then approved by President George W. Bush. Grenier is a 27-year veteran of the CIA's clandestine service and renowned expert on Middle East, Southeast, and counterterrorism. In his new book, 88 Days to Kandahar, a CIA diary, Grenier writes about forging alliances with warlords, maneuvering around Taliban dissidents, and launching the Southern Campaign, orchestrating the defeat of the Taliban, and supporting Hamid Karzai's rise to power in 88 chaotic days. It is a great pleasure to welcome Robert Grenier to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Very nice to have you here. Again, the name of the book, 88 Days to Kandahar, a CIA diary. When you look at these 88 days, at the beginning, how clear was the mission?
Well, you know, there was some confusion about the mission at the outset, and that was actually part of the problem. You know, obviously it was Al-Qaeda that had struck us at 9/11, and we wanted to strike a blow back at them. We wanted to make sure that they would never be able to hit us again. But by the same token, it was every bit as important, although maybe not quite as fully realized at the time, that we really needed to do something about Afghanistan. At the end of the day, it was the Taliban, who was then ruling most of Afghanistan, who had been the hosts of the Al-Qaeda international terrorists. And the thing that I tried to stress to the administration at the time was that while it was well within our military capacity to chase them out of Afghanistan, unless there was some competent authority willing to keep them out, there was nothing to stop them from coming back. And so very quickly, our task became to try to marshal our military effort in such a way as to encourage the creation of a responsible political establishment in Afghanistan that would keep that country from being a terrorist safe haven in the future.
And ultimately, what you write about in the book is as you call it, the first Afghan war, that the principles that were followed, you believe, in successfully waging that war were ignored thereafter, and ultimately led to a 13-year decline and as you say, a debacle of a policy and a war with very little insight as to what the mission was.
Well, you know, as often happens, I think that there was a great deal of mission creep at work. At the outset, we laid down some very, very clear rules. We said, look, at the end of the day, this is a fight for Afghans. We need to marshal our own military effort in a way that will empower Afghans to do over the long term what we can't, and that is to keep Afghanistan from ever being a terrorist safe haven again. And so the U.S. footprint was very small. It was very light. We were aiding the Northern Alliance, which had been long engaged in a civil war with the Taliban up in the north. And most importantly, in my view, we were aiding Afghan tribal leaders in the south to encourage them and to militarily support them in overthrowing the Taliban. And that's what happened, you know, during those 88 days. Those 88 days ended on the 7th of December 2001 when the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were driven out of the Taliban capital, which was Kandahar, down in the southern part of the country. When by 2005 we could see the Taliban beginning to regain traction in certain parts of the country, though, we put aside the principles that had guided us the first time around. And essentially, we decided that Afghanistan was too important to be left to Afghans. Americans really took over the struggle. As you know, we had over 100,000 U.S. troops, an additional 40,000 from NATO. We were spending $100 billion a year at the height. And basically, we just overwhelmed that country and tried to do things that Afghans themselves could not sustain over the long term. We tried to turn Afghanistan into something that it was not and arguably could not be. And I think that's what led to the situation that we see currently, where once again Afghanistan is trapped in a civil war. There are large parts of the country that are now under effective Taliban control, and the future viability of the government in Kabul is very much in question.
As you note, the title of the book, 88 Days to Kandahar, refers to the 88 days from 9/11 until December 7th, 2001, when the Taliban was driven from its capital in Kandahar by Afghan warlords, their militias, operating in league with CIA operatives and U.S. Special Forces. Your title at the point, you were the CIA's chief of station for Pakistan and Afghanistan based in Islamabad. So it was up to you to direct the war because it was a CIA-led campaign. So describe how that came about.
Well, it came about because CIA had long been engaged in that part of the world. The CIA had longstanding relationships with tribal leaders, warlords, if you will, who had fought against the Soviets during the 1980s. In the months leading up to 9/11, I and members of my station sought to reestablish those old relationships, hoping that we could foment a rebellion against the Taliban that would help to force the Taliban to change its policy with regard to bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And that's what gave us sort of a running start when 9/11 did happen. We had reestablished those relationships. And so because this was supposed to be an Afghan-led effort and it was the CIA that had the relationships with these people, that's what put CIA in the driver's seat in conducting that campaign.
At the time, and as you say, it worked very well when it came to special forces providing military advice and directing the airstrikes that would enable the militias, the Afghan militias, to defeat the Taliban. When did things start to go wrong?
Well, I think the history hasn't been completely written on this, and it's a very complicated history, and you almost have to go district by district in Afghanistan to try to piece together what happened. But I think that fundamentally, and ultimately, I think that the real mistakes here were made by Afghans. But that said, that there was a great deal more that the U.S. could have done, I think, to encourage good behavior on the part of our Afghan allies. And I think that a big mistake that was made by our allies was that they didn't include a place in the new Afghanistan, if you will, for the Taliban. The Taliban was willing to accept a new regime, and yet they and those who had been allied with them during the 1990s were essentially marginalized by the victors. And that gave them a motivation to try to rise up against the current political establishment in Afghanistan. And I think a big part of it was a lack of command attention on the part of the United States. So we turned our focus on Iraq. I myself went off to head up the CIA effort on Iraq for 2.5 years. And by the time I came back to refocus on that area, this time as the director of the Counterterrorism Center at CIA, and made an extensive trip out to the region in the spring of 2005, you could see that the Taliban was beginning to reestablish itself. And there were important decisions to be made at that point, and I think that, frankly, we made the wrong ones. Now, whether what I would regard as the right ones would have worked or not, we will never know. But as I mentioned at the outset, the strategic mistake that we made at that point from 2005 onward was essentially to take over the conduct of the war ourselves and to try to essentially remake Afghanistan.
And that is what makes your story so fascinating, is because in working with others and sort of directing the players, if you will, in those 88 days, how do you believe that could have been effective in further disbanding the Taliban?
Well, you know, I think we as a government made some decisions. Let's remember that the reason that the Taliban rose to power in the first place was because of the very bad behavior by those many of those same Afghan warlords who would eventually become our allies. They fell after they drove the Soviets out at the end of the 1980s. They immediately fell to fighting amongst themselves, and Afghanistan was a chaotic place. And that's what gave the Taliban the opportunity to appeal to the mass of the Afghan people, particularly in the Pashtun areas in the south and the east of the country, to follow an Islamic path and to at least establish law and order. That's really what the Taliban was able to do, but they were able to do that very effectively. And I think the U.S. government made the decision after what we thought was the defeat of the Taliban that, look, we don't want to reprise the past. What we need to do, we shouldn't see Afghanistan or encourage Afghanistan to be ruled as it has been in the past. What we really need to have is a very strong central government with a large Afghan army that's able to impose its will on the entire country. And the problem was that has really never existed in Afghanistan. The army that we tried to build in Afghanistan was one that no Afghan state would ever be able to maintain. It's a small, primitive agrarian country, would never have the resources to maintain that size of an army or a national police force. And so essentially we made our effort to create the perfect the enemy of the good. I was hoping that we would be engaged in key areas of the country, helping warlords and people who had local tribal legitimacy to rule their own areas to be the best warlords that they could be. But that didn't have a whole lot of appeal, particularly for the U.S. military. And so instead, we set out on another path to try to create a system in Afghanistan that Afghans themselves were not willing and not able to sustain.
Robert Grenier is the author of the new book, 88 Days to Kandahar, a CAA Diary. You were talking a moment ago about how you ultimately led the counterterrorism center. But during that first Afghan war, you had enormous difficulties with the counterterrorism center. You talk about the rivalry and the meddling by many bureaucrats within the Pentagon. What was the situation, and what ultimately do you believe was causing that?
Well, you know, if you look at the inside story of most wars, you will see something that's not dissimilar. Inside histories of the Second World War, for instance, feature all sorts of petty rivalries, bureaucratic squabbles, even at a time when the country was literally fighting for its life. And I don't mean to suggest a direct analogy between the little war that we fought in Afghanistan and World War II. There's a little difference in scale there. But I think that some of the principles of human nature, if you will, are very, very similar. And so, you know, I didn't write this in a way to try to call my former enemies to account. But I wanted to give people a realistic idea of what it is when a country sets about to conduct a struggle in which there are legitimate differences of opinion, and also where there are personal rivalries that come into play. And so I hope that's an interesting part of the story, but it certainly was something which greatly affected my life at the time. And I was fortunate that in the end I was able to make my own views prevail, but I think if you take a look at how the sausage was made, it was not particularly pretty.
You write in the book, in an offhanded way, you write about Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, who you believe, you know, wanted to be in charge, was not in charge, and caused problems. But you say, okay, but that was manageable.
Yeah, I think it was largely manageable. It was clear that the secretary was not happy, but he knew how the president wanted this war to be conducted. And at a tactical level, where you had CIA coming together, particularly with special forces on the ground, that actually worked quite smoothly, because you had people who were faced with a common problem. They had a common view of the objective. They each had to understand the relative skills of the other, and they had to depend on one another. And so that relationship worked very, very well. It's only when you get several stages removed and you start looking at this from the perspective of people back in Washington, where bureaucratic rivalry really is the order of the day, that's where the problems arise. But again, we were able to do what we needed to do at the tactical level, and Secretary Rumsfeld, although he's not entirely happy about it, was still able to marshal his forces to make sure that they did what they needed to do in conjunction with CIA on the ground.
You end the book with a chapter entitled Acceptance. So where are we now with America having left Afghanistan and still a presence, obviously, but still with our current state? There's obviously still problems. There's obviously going to be further problems. So what are the chances of us going back to even what you write about in this book as a way of dealing with the issues, or has that ship sailed completely?
Oh, I don't think that ship has sailed completely. And I think that there are certain lessons that we need to draw from our experience in Afghanistan that are actually directly applicable elsewhere. We were fortunate enough during the first American-Afghan War that we had effective allies on the ground. It could easily have been otherwise. We didn't have very many in the southern part of the country, and they could easily have been killed. We were fortunate that they weren't, and they were able to see the effort through. We have an analogous situation right now in Iraq and Syria. The president has said that he wants to degrade and ultimately defeat the so-called Islamic State, which has taken over large swaths of territory in both of those countries, Syria and Iraq. And yet the allies that we have on the ground in Iraq are not effective, to say the very least, and in Syria they're virtually non-existent. And so there will be, over time, and we're beginning to see already, a temptation to try to get the U.S. out there in a much more forceful role out in front. And I think that would be a very big mistake. I think we need to take a long view. We need to have strategic patience. We need to bring indigenous forces on the ground who do have motivations that are parallel with ours, and help to maneuver them over time in a position where they can do what we can't do over the long term in defeating the Islamic State. And my concern is that although the front lines in the global jihad, if you will, have shifted elsewhere in the world, that as those forces are ultimately rolled back, and I think they ultimately will be, they will be looking for other safe havens that they can infest. And I fear that they will once again return to Afghanistan, because there will be significant parts of Afghanistan that will be likely safe havens for those people, and that we will have to reprise the past once again. I just hope that we do it a little bit more wisely than we have in the past.
Robert Grenier is our guest this morning. He's talking about his new book, 88 Days to Kandahar, a CIA Diary. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. We'll continue our conversation with Robert Grenier after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Robert Grenier is our guest this morning. He has served as CIA Chief of Station for Pakistan and Afghanistan during 9/11. He also has served as CIA's White House representative during the Iraq campaign and then as director of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. His new book is 88 Days to Kandahar, a CIA Diary. Just a couple of issues that I want to talk to you about before we wrap up. One, of course, is in the days following 9/11, and great concern, and of course we've learned much more over the past several years about the interrogation policies implemented by the CIA in the months following 9/11. I'm curious as to how much you were a part of and aware of those policies and where you stood on them and how you defend or look at them now.
Yeah, I wasn't, with regard to detention and interrogation of terrorist suspects, I wasn't present at the creation. That all started in 2002 while I was still in Pakistan. Now, I will say that the first senior member of Al-Qaeda, that is Abu Zubaydah, was captured in Pakistan on my watch, and he was turned over to the CIA, and they took him off someplace else to be ultimately to be interrogated, and I didn't have any role in putting that interrogation program together. Where I intersected with it was later at the end of 2004, beginning of 2005, when I became myself the head of the Counterterrorism Center. And at that point, we had a full-blown interrogation program that was underway. And so that was something that I inherited. And I could see for myself that just how effective it was. Now, when I say it, I'm talking about interrogations of senior members of al-Qaeda who came into our hands, mostly in Pakistan, but they're also turned over to us by some other cooperating countries, the majority of whom were interrogated in, if you will, in a traditional manner and didn't see anything any more harsh than what you would expect to see in a normal police precinct in the United States. That said, there were others, a minority of them, against whom harsher methods were employed. I think that obviously that has generated a great deal of controversy, but at the end of the day, I guess my view on this is that the CIA will follow the rules that it is given, provided that they are satisfied that those rules are legal. And the CIA sought and received on multiple occasions full assurances from the Department of Justice that what it was being asked to do was, in fact, legal. Obviously, the current administration, current Justice Department feels differently, and that's perfectly fine. I mean, this is an elected government, and their precepts have to be followed. But I guess where I differ from some of the critics is that it really, to me, comes down to a question as to what sort of an intelligence service do we want to have? Do we want to have an intelligence service that will be responsive to the demands of an elected president once they are receive the appropriate assurances that what they're being asked to do is legal? Or do we want to have an intelligence service that decides for itself and as dictated by its own bureaucratic interests which of its legal orders it will follow and which it will not? I think that the latter situation is very unhealthy, and I'm concerned that the reaction within the CIA and within the intelligence community to some of the current ex post facto criticism that it's receiving could be just that, that they will decide which of their legal orders they'll follow and which ones they won't.
You do write about in the book, and I've heard you talk about our need to be patient, that we must be patient as we look now to the threat of ISIS in Iraq and in Syria and the latest death to come as a result of ISIS. So at what point, with talk of troops, with talk of changing the playing field, at what point do we end patience?
Well, I'm in favor of open-ended patience, and I think that one of the real challenges in all of this is a domestic political one. You know, Americans, we have a model of in our minds as to how a war ought to be fought, and I think some of this, you know, still relates to our experience in the Second World War. You know, we don't want to play for a tie. You know, we believe that if we are forced to use military means to defend our national interests, that we should use overwhelming force and we should get in, we should get out and be done with it. One of the real challenges that is, I think, very difficult for us to explain, frankly, to the American people in a domestic political context is the nature of the struggle that we're fighting right now. And part of our problem is that this is not our struggle. If you look at it writ large, this is a struggle for the heart, the soul, and the future of the Islamic world. And at the end of the day, it's Muslims who are going to have to determine what that future is going to be. Now, we have a strong national interest in the outcome of that struggle. Obviously, we want to influence it in what we believe to be the right direction to the extent that we possibly can. But when we get involved in the lead, we change the nature of the struggle itself. And rather than an argument about how Muslims should rule themselves, it becomes a struggle between unbelievers and true believers in Islam. And that's a struggle that we're going to lose every time if we allow it to be framed in that way. So that's why it's very important, I think, for us to be working through allies, and we have natural allies throughout the Muslim world, rather than taking the struggle over ourselves in a way that actually weakens our natural allies. And you know, we can talk about that. I can try to explain it. It's not a very satisfying situation. Americans don't like open-ended struggles, but I think that we need to be focusing on going light, going long, remaining engaged, but understanding that at the end of the day, we will inevitably depend on others to prevail, and making sure that our efforts in the meantime are sustainable. And I think if done properly, the efforts that we have to mount in places like Iraq and Syria, Afghanistan, parts of Pakistan, Yemen and elsewhere are sustainable, but we have to avoid doing what, for instance, we did in the latter years in Afghanistan, which is overcommitting in a way that the indigenous people really cannot sustain, and which we ourselves cannot sustain. Nobody in this country is going to argue that we can fight, you know, 10 and 20 year wars involving 100,000 troops and $100 billion a year. Even we, as large and powerful as we are, can't sustain that kind of an effort.
And as we see recently with another young woman killed by ISIS, and we see those pictures and a picture worth a thousand words, that case is even harder to make to the American people, especially when it is seen in such a way.
That's absolutely right. And there will be atrocities that will inflame people in this country. But I think we should be quick to notice that some of these atrocities, particularly the one involving this Jordanian Air Force pilot who was burned to death, apparently, by the Islamic State, had a very emotional impact, particularly in Jordan, but elsewhere in the region. And at the end of the day, these are the people who are going to have to fight and prevail the struggle. The nature of their enemy is evil, even very much, you know, by their notions as well. And so I think that ultimately, you know, given the array of forces throughout the Muslim world, these extremists are not representative. They will ultimately be rolled back and defeated. And I think that we need to be very patient to make sure that we are a part of that solution and don't impede that solution.
What you write about in this book certainly is not taught in a history class. It is not taught in civics. Should it be? Should we have a better sense of what's going, as you say, of how that sausage is made?
I think that it's useful for Americans to be realistic, among other things, about what we can legitimately do and what we legitimately can't. I think we are a large and powerful country. We have important responsibilities, not just interests, but also responsibilities in the world. But there are limits to our power as well. There are also limits to our own knowledge and our own wisdom. And I think the more acquainted Americans can become of that fact, the better informed they will be in selecting their leaders in the future.
Robert Grenier's new book is 88 Days to Kandahar, a CIA diary. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Robert Grenier, thank you very much for spending time with us. Great pleasure.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, 88 Days to Kandahar, a CIA diary. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Robert Grenier, our guest. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.